Welcome to the Bike Portland podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Maas. For this episode, I caught up with veteran advocate and recent Portland transplant, Kathy Tuttle. Kathy has been an activist for climate change, transportation, and healthy cities for over 30 years, and has a long list of accomplishments and awards for her work as a community organizer, a nonprofit founder and leader, and a city staffer. In 2019, she ran for a seat on Seattle City Council and tied for third in a very crowded race. And last summer, this 65-year-old self-described climate warrior decided to move to Portland, currently lives downtown, and uses a bike as her main way to get around. You might have seen the This Machine Fights Climate Change sign attached to the basket on the front of her bike. While some people might look to be taking a break after working for so hard for so long on these issues, Kathy is just as committed as ever to make an impact and was just voted to the board of Bike Loud PDX, a local nonprofit whose main goal is to push Portland into being a city where 25% of all trips are made by bike by 2030. As an armchair activist myself, I really loved talking to someone with as much experience on this stuff as Kathy has. In this interview, you'll hear why she chose to move to Portland, how her bike has become her personal mobility device, and how she's avoided burnout after more than three decades of advocacy. We also talked about how being a bureaucrat helped her become a better advocate. Kath and I also traded thoughts about the state of bicycling and transportation reform in Portland, whether current PBOT Commissioner Joanne Hardesty is or can be a real champion for the cause, and how Kathy's recently completed Car Master Plan project unlocks important clues on how to help us reach that exciting 25% cycling goal. Here's our conversation. Kathy Tuttle, thanks for taking time to talk today.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me. And it's nice to actually like formally talk to you rather than just running into you at events.
Yeah, which we've done several times, those sort of side conversations, which I feel bad for sometimes because I'm just like always focused on like this photo I should get or someone, and this, don't take this wrong, but like someone I should be talking to that's like at the event. And I'm like, always have this work first mentality for better, for worse. So anyways, I wish it is nice to talk to you outside of that sort of thing. But just to kind of help people get to know Kathy Tuttle a little bit more, what is your, and this, take this sort of for your whole life, like what is your sort of relationship to how you've moved around mobility wise, you know, throughout your life, and how have you seen streets and moved through them?
So I've evolved. You know, I mean, I remember, you know, when I was in my 20s and 30s, driving a lot of places, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, probably we've all evolved a lot. I don't think we all grew up on bikes, you know, unless we live in the Netherlands. But, you know, it's only in the last, I'd say, 20 years that I've become a dedicated and, you know, fervent bicycle person. You know, I mean, I really define that as my mobility device. And as I'm aging, you know, I just turned 65 this year. As I'm aging, it's actually turning into seriously my mobility device. It's a thing that allows me, it's a vehicle that allows me to get around a lot more comfortably as an old person, which, you know, I didn't realize that it would kind of evolve into that. But when I'm exploring new cities, I, you know, I just in September went to New York for a couple of weeks. You know, I was able to see a lot of all five boroughs of New York by being on a bicycle. I would not have been able to do that if I didn't have a bicycle, but it allowed me to bike with the bike share that they had there 20 miles a day. You know, imagine trying to do that by walking or any other way.
Right. And did you always live in Seattle area? So when you were driving around as a younger person, what city was that in?
No, I grew up in the East Coast. I grew up in Pittsburgh and then lived for a while in New York.
Okay.
Went to school in California in Los Angeles area, and actually lived for a couple of different sabbaticals. I went with my husband to Israel for 1 year, to Japan for 1 year, and then to Sweden for 1 year, the most recent sabbatical. And I think Sweden was where I was really radicalized into a serious bicycle advocate.
Yeah, you mentioned like you have such an impressive background and a diverse background in terms of the different types of roles you've had, from academia, you know, community activism, which goes back to like 80s and 90s doing climate change related stuff, right? Which is long before a lot of people listening to this, I think, were focused on it. So you were a City of Seattle staffer at one point for a good chunk of time there, 6-7 years, I think. You were a nonprofit founder and executive director of Seattle Neighborhood Greenways. And more recently, you were a city council candidate. And here you are sort of like in Portland, still on these front lines as an activist, you know, being recently voted onto the board of Bike Loud PDX, which is a local nonprofit bike group. And I noticed recently on your LinkedIn profile, you wrote something that was saying how, you know, we don't have time to wait. These crises that face us require us to rethink how we use public space. And I'm just curious, how have you kept that sort of urgency going for yourself? How do you keep that urgency going for yourself?
I guess it's because I really can see a vision of where we need to go. I don't think it's hopeless. I think that that's when a lot of advocates burn out, is they sort of just throw up their hands in despair and say it's not going to work. And I really believe that I believe for a long time, but I believe right now that we really are on the cusp of changing the way that we approach living in cities, living together, and getting around. I do believe that getting around by bicycle is a key element of all of that too, a key kind of connector.
Yeah, and I think anybody who's in this space of trying to change cities to be better places or to be different than they are now and to sort of shake the status quo, whether it's climate change activism or transportation, anything like that, I think we all have to sort of be hopeful. We have to have some hope. And I want to really underscore here for folks that are listening that you worked for like climate change related groups and helped start some of them in the Seattle area as far back as sort of like the mid-90s. And to hear you just say that you're still optimistic. So is there something that's happened in recent years that, in terms of this issue, I have my own answer to this, of course, you know, it's sort of like it's become mainstream. We have this movie called Don't Look Up. We have all these things recently. But like in your mind, is that giving you hope that sort of like we're finally this time going to get it, or finally this time going to move the needle a little bit for these things you really care about?
Well, what really needs to happen is that, you know, unfortunately, we still do rely on elected leaders and the capitalists to do the right thing. And they are paying attention now. They are saying, you know, we aren't going to all be able to get into some stupid rocket and go to outer space and live on the moon. We actually do have a planet where we are going to need to look up now and pay attention to it and change the way that we organize life in cities where we're living now. And there is no hiding place. You know, you really do have to make that change. And I think that seeing what's happening in the mainstream media right now for climate reporting is very heartening. You know, it really is something that people are paying attention to. They're not paying enough attention to it, but they're paying attention to it in a way that, you know, I remember when I started a 350.org Seattle group in 2009, I think, and it was just awful trying to get you know, news reporting for it, you know, to try to get anybody in the mainstream media interested in some big organizing efforts that we were doing, and big, you know, we had to be a lot more thoughtful about getting attention for the work we were doing. Whereas now I think a lot of climate action is covered by the media. And that's heartening, because people are starting to pay attention. They you know, there's a lot of information and a lot of misinformation still, but I think people are paying attention.
Hmm. And you left advocacy at one point and did go to work for sort of the inside, the City of Seattle. You were a project manager and planner in the Parks Bureau, if I'm not mistaken, right? Something like that.
Yeah, I was with the Planning Commission for a while, so kind of local neighborhood planning, and then I worked for the Parks Department, where I helped put together a lot of parks plans and actually got to see a lot of them developed.
And sort of, you know, when I hear you being on the inside like that and sort of knowing about your broader body of work, I mean, I'm going to assume that did you leave because of the red tape and bureaucracy, or sort of like, why did you not continue that career as a city staffer?
It was fascinating work. I mean, I think it was one of the most interesting, the parks work was some of the most interesting work I ever did. And it was very rewarding because I was dealing with a lot of community issues, but there was a lot of red tape too. I remember for 3 years I had to fight to get a green roof put on a Seattle Parks project. And the battle was between the people who took care of roofs in the Parks Department and the people who took care of grounds in the Parks Department. And they were arguing who should maintain this green roof, the roof people or the grounds people. And it went back and forth about this maintenance agreement for 3 years.
Well, so it's maddening as a city staffer, but enlightening as an advocate, right? As somebody who works to change on the outside. So what did you take away from that experience at the city that helped make your advocacy more effective?
Oh, I mean, it gave me tremendous compassion for project managers and for people trying to get change done at the local level, how much work they put into to trying to make sense of city rules, of union rules, of trying to bring a whole lot of groups together to actually move a project forward. I mean, how many different balls you have juggling in the air when you're trying to get a project off the ground. That really gave me, as I said, a compassion towards city staff that has served me well in my advocacy career.
And so getting that balance right of creating pressure and maybe calling out city officials for not doing enough versus that compassion and understanding and remembering that they're people too and they have a tremendous amount of constraints and things that they're trying to balance. But that is such an important balance and such an important sort of tone to get right.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that, you know, people's hearts, particularly in municipal and city staff, tend to be really in the right place for the most part. You know, they really, people go into bureaucracy because they are public servants, because they're publicly minded. They want to do the right thing. I mean, sometimes they get ground down or just burned out or whatever, and they turn into ogres. But for the most part, they are really, really good people trying to do the best they have with the constraints that they're given.
And despite your insights into what it was like working at the city, you were going to throw your hat in the ring to be a member of city council in Seattle in 2019. You finished a respectable 13% of the vote or something like that, which is pretty interesting in your campaign. That was an interesting run. I love seeing some of the reporting on that and seeing you sort of framed as a politician or a would-be politician instead of an advocate. That was fun. But what did you take away from that experience running for city council in Seattle?
Well, I think running for political office in some ways is the next logical step of being a committed advocate. You know, you really are embodying it 24/7 when you become a politician, or can be somebody that does that. I mean, CONFAM locally is somebody that's really shown that pathway, and I think very strongly. And I guess one of the things I learned is I was one of those people that went out when I was campaigning for 8 hours a day and knocked on doors, is how much I didn't know about my neighbors, how much I didn't know about the city. Even though I'd been working very closely with neighborhood groups and talking to people and, you know, for the last 20 years prior to that, and how it was an experience that I'm really glad to have had, because I guess another aspect of my background is I have a master's degree in anthropology. And this was, I mean, running for office is city anthropology. I mean, that's what you're doing, is you're gathering primary sources day after day after day. I mean, I did it for 6 months or something like that, knocking on doors 8 hours a day. It was exhausting. I lost 30 pounds. You know, I mean, it was, that's all you do is you go up the next flight of stairs and knock on doors and talk to people and down the next. And it was great. It was great, but it was grueling but valuable.
Fascinating. So you were sort of a big deal in Seattle. So why, after all everything you know about that city and all the heart and soul you put into it, why pick up your roots and move to Portland?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. I mean, one was, as we talked about it at the beginning of this chat, was I'd been here a couple of times, and met some of the city staff here and met some of the advocates here. And it just seemed like a city that could fit me well, particularly as I'm aging. I'm 65, like I said. And I thought, well, this could be an interesting city to age in place. But the main motivator that brought me here was PCEF, the Portland Clean Energy Fund, that was just launched 3 years ago now, voted on and launched. And I knew somebody on, or know somebody on the PCEF Oversight Board who told me about the program. I was fascinated with it as an energy advocate myself, as a climate advocate. And I wanted to see how that was playing out. Well, so I thought being here would give me an on-the-ground seat looking at the development of a very innovative fund. I don't know how much you followed it, PCEF.
Sort of tangentially related to other stuff, looking for opportunities to cover it and amplify it when it was necessary, but haven't gotten ever super deep into it.
Right. And it's not at all transportation related. It's mm-hmm. about clean energy right. retrofits. And a little bit about food advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I took away from that effort was sort of just how it came about and how they built the coalition around it, and sort of how that sort of broke some molds. And also obviously recognizing that it helped catapult, like for one, I think Confom, who's state rep now. And the way people in town that I respect talked about that process and that whole initiative sort of gave me the signal that it was something worth respecting and paying attention to, because people spoke about it so highly. So that's kind of how I track issues that aren't necessarily my core issue in terms of Bike Portland, but that I need to sort of respect and know what they are doing and how they might intersect. But yeah, so.
And it was actually, you're right, a brilliant example of a very strong community building, particularly in the BIPOC community.
Yeah, which has been like a hallmark of Kathy Tuttle's advocacy all over this time, is coalition building, right? You had this really neat quote I heard when I was doing a little bit of research before we talk, where you said something like, we're not a blade of grass, we're an entire field of grass, or something like that. But you've that's always been a really important constant in your work, I think, is coalition building, which, you know, I think for worse mostly, not for, there's no better to it, but Portland, I feel like, has only really discovered that in a very intentional way pretty late. I think like the Metro 2020 transportation package that didn't pass here, but that was a big effort. You know, everybody talked about how that was so important because they built coalitions. Obviously, like you mentioned, the Clean Energy Fund work was like this coalition. And I feel like even some of the big transportation advocacy groups in town and other groups weren't really known for coalition building in the past. But I think the last several years, that's become such an important piece, especially as the equity and racial justice components have become more important to people, at least on more people's radar in town that do this kind of work. I feel like now coalition building has become more of a standard thing to expect here. But looking at some of your past, I think that is something that you've always done, is brought a bunch of different people along. And it's how you formed some of the groups you worked with. I mean, way back several decades ago, in terms of, you know, getting different groups to come together. And it's been, I think, a real interesting part of just your style in general and how you approach these issues. Like, one of the things, I don't know if folks remember, but the group that Kathy was involved with, Seattle Neighborhood Greenways, was really instrumental in sort of like pushing forward this idea of like removing labels from transportation and trying to talk about bicycle advocacy, not as putting bikes front and center and not talking about bicyclists and motorists and drivers, but to really center people in all that sort of stuff. And I think that kind of gets to this idea of sort of like broadening how you talk about this stuff, and then the outcomes can hopefully have broader support, or at least the work, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, with Seattle Neighborhood Greenways, we introduced a lot of ideas about people who bike instead of bicyclists, or people who walk instead of pedestrians. And if you start to talk in that way, you start to see yourself in that way too. I am a person who bikes instead of I'm a bicyclist. And I still use that to frame all the language that I use.
Okay, I'm going to bounce back a little bit and say, so you land in Portland, you're here in Portland, you'd visited it before as a transportation reformer person, you're certainly aware Portland's been on your radar. So now that you're here, and you've been here for what, a year or so?
Not, 6 months.
6 months?
It feels like a year, but yes.
Oh my gosh, Kathy. Okay, so yeah, 6 months. So still pretty new, but you definitely had a summer to get out, and you're on your bike all the time.
Yay!
Yes. Yay. You've done tons of riding and events and stuff. So better or worse than you expected? I mean, what are some things that pop up when you say, "Gosh, Portland was really behind," or "Gee, they're even better than I thought," or what can you share about that?
I love the waterfront trails. I think that Portland is unique in having such excellent access to the water among large cities. And I like the fact that there are relatively safe ways to get across all the bridges. Not perfect, but relatively safe. Pieces of the greenways still make me happy. Signage is pretty good. That is, you know, you can sort of figure out looking at the street signs and the directional signs, particularly in the downtownish area, you can figure out how to get around by bike. But overall, I think a lot of what I just talked about, the waterfront trails, the signs, the greenways, are things that went in the 90s. And that's a lot of what I'm feeling, is that I thought that movement was continuing, and it really has been sliding a lot. A couple of the staff that I was very excited about are still around at PBOT. Timo Forsberg, you know, am I allowed to like name check people? I mean, you know, these are like people that
of course. Advocrats, I used to call them, Kathy, right? Advocrats.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Greg Raisman, you know, there's people that are like, he's out still out there painting the streets. Timo is still out there trying to activate new people on bikes. But there's not a lot of emphasis on that. There's not a lot of emphasis on actually recreating the city in a way, particularly in a way with the pandemic, that a lot of cities are looking at as an opportunity. I kind of thought Portland would take that opportunity and run with it. They've given some money and some street space to the street seats program, the business program on the streets, but not to the extent that a lot of other cities have. They haven't used the pandemic as an opportunity to close down streets or to put in miles and miles of bike infrastructure that a lot of other cities have. I mean, I think that the pandemic opportunity was lost. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, just they have actually closed some streets, some block faces. There are some pretty big capital projects going on, like say NATO. But you're saying that stuff should have been sort of expected, or that's just normal progress, and you would have thought there would have been maybe more grasping of the opportunity of the pandemic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that the pandemic, and it isn't just the pandemic. I mean, I think it stretches back before that there has not for a couple of years been a politician who has had the movement of people by walking and biking in their political portfolio.
Right. And I think you've identified something that I've certainly felt for years. You know, we've been talking about stagnation in Portland in terms of the spirit and the sort of the thing that everybody used to look to Portland for, which was innovation in these realms of bike advocacy and transportation reform and all this stuff. And it really strikes me, because when you really got going with Seattle Neighborhood Greenways, which for folks that don't know, look it up, it's a great group. And they really started, if I'm not mistaken, right, to sort of establish neighborhood greenways as a concept and really help Seattle build sort of its first network of people-centered streets, right? So it strikes me that your job as an advocate in Seattle was to like introduce that to a city staff and to a city that hadn't really had that on the radar, staffers that weren't really sort of bike inclined or people centered in general. And you did a pretty good job at that. You know, Seattle Neighborhood Greenways.
That's exactly why we came down to Portland. We came down to Portland in 2012, and I brought city council members. I brought our new traffic engineer, Dong Ho Chang, with us. You know, I brought people that work for the city and that were elected leaders as well as advocates to Portland and said, hey, look at how things are working in Portland. They're doing a pretty good job. You know, we can do it Jill in Seattle. And so we took lessons. You know, I had the traffic engineer meet with the traffic engineer here, and the electeds meet with the electeds, and the advocates meet with the advocates. And then we all took it back. We were here for 3 days, talked to you then, I think. And then actually we came back 2 years, but then we went to Vancouver, BC for the next year of learning. And then the third year we took, brought people back for Sunday Parkways.
Right. But it strikes me that now fast forward and now, so you did that in Seattle and you introduced it and you sort of, I think, created this cadre of people-centered engineers and planners within the city. Hopefully they're still there doing great work. And yes, Seattle Neighborhood Greenways is strong. And I think there's still that pretty good ecosystem up there. But then here you are in Portland, where now we used to have that, but it has certainly dipped and we've lost a lot of that sort of, I think, energy and spirit and urgency. And you're still, and you're here to try to, I guess, more, your role is going to be more to remind everybody about that, to remind them of what they can do. And that maybe, is that kind of what you see your role is?
One of the things that does make me excited about particularly Bike Loud, but just about Portland in general, is that there is this basis for really good bike infrastructure. There is Pedalpalooza that's doing amazing things and getting 10, 20, 30,000 people out on bikes every summer. There is Sunday Parkways that's getting a similar number of people out on bikes every year. There is this network of streets, of good ways to get across the rivers, of ways that people can see themselves as people who bike in Portland, and a whole network of I think, some very good planners at various levels within city government. There's a lot of strong bike shops. There's a lot of strong just people who are thinking about that. There's the PSU program that Jennifer Dill runs. I mean, there's a lot of material there to work with. It's just a question of visioning something that's going to actually work for people in the future.
Yeah, it's almost like all the stuff that we used to be way more excited about, it's actually still there. It's just people, for some reason, are less excited. And I wonder if what happened was a lot of the advocacy sort of ecosystem and people involved in that sphere, we'd set such high hopes for ourselves and such high expectations that when we faced some battles and when we faced some trials and we faced some maybe disappointments, and yes, I am maybe projecting some of my own stuff here, when we faced some of those things and we experienced some political issues where we sort of lost some champions and stuff like that, maybe it's like that sort of, you know, resulted in some people getting a little bit disheartened and crestfallen. And then because there are so many other big issues in front of people in the city, from housing affordability first, and then obviously, you know, racial justice, police reform, all these things took over center stage. And then we sort of lost, I think, some of the energy. So have you ever wondered, like, why in the short time you've been here, but like any posits about what's going on here and why maybe we aren't sort of that shining beacon on the hill that we once were, that you traveled to 10 years ago just to get advice?
Well, you know, as I was listing all of these great organizations and infrastructure of biking that still remain in Portland, one thing I left off was Bike Portland. And, you know, I do want to know what's kept you going, Jonathan. I mean, I think that, you know, you are a big part of the glue that's held the idea of Portland can be a biking city together over the last 10 years. And, you know, hats off to you, because it takes a lot of energy to keep on going and keep on believing and keep on learning new ways of presenting information, podcasts and movies and whatnot. And so yeah, I think that what's happened is that we don't have that kind of critical mass of a politician or multiple politicians who have biking in their portfolio. We don't have the landowners who care enough to say, this is something we want for our city. I mean, there's a, you know, bunch of property owners, Goodmans and Zidels and Marxes and whatevers, who aren't saying, hey, we want Portland to be that biking city. We don't have the kind of big businesses, particularly the sportswear businesses, that are saying, hey, we want Portland to be a biking city, but we still have the advocates. So I think the thing that needs to pull people together, and the thing that Bike Loud has just said, is, hey, you've put this thing in the plan that says 25% of all trips can be by bike in in 2030, 8 years from now. Let's actually make that a vision. Let's actually pull it together. So there hasn't been the vision, and I think now there might be.
Well, it's such an interesting conundrum, because for several years there, and I know you're familiar with this phenomenon, and because it went all the way through the bike advocacy spheres, nationally, regionally, locally, everywhere, where it became sort of, it became a thing to de-emphasize biking. And there were a lot of reasons for that. Biking is and was to some, was and is to some degree, but it certainly, it was reasonable to think this about biking, that it was too white, too male-centric, right? It was all about spandex, all about competition. There's all these things, all this baggage that the biking had. So the whole sort of industry around bike advocacy acknowledged that, I think, to some degree. And so it resulted in, I think, a lot of groups and even national, even big nonprofit groups like, you know, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance changing their name to the Street Trust. And I noticed something about you that in a 2014 article about Seattle Neighborhood Greenways is that you specifically didn't brand yourselves as biking advocates. You branded yourself as neighborhood advocates, right? So, and I sort of did that to some degree too with Bike Portland, although it's hard because our name is Bike Portland, but we covered a range of issues and I was very conscious about not being sort of bike centric. But then here we are in this moment where you're just sort of advocating just your last thing you said about how it's important to remind people that biking is important, right? So I don't want people to forget that we were all about saying biking was important and bike marketing was at an all-time high and we had champions in City Hall and we had business owners and developers and like biking was the first or second word out of everyone's mouth in Portland for all this time. And then we sort of consciously we had outside pressure to sort of say, hey, y'all bikers, you need to calm down. Don't be saying bike first all the time. And I think for the most part, the biking community, for lack of a better way to describe it, sort of took that to heart and reduced sort of that and stepped back a little bit and all these things. And now I feel like there's some momentum, and I think you're sort of illustrative of that, of saying, actually, we do need to put biking front and center and we need to sort of remind people, but maybe we do it in a different way and we take the lessons we've learned in this past 4 or 5 years and then we put biking first, but not put biking first in the old way, put it first with the understanding, you know, these new complexities that come with that. Is that kind of how you see it?
Well, I mean, I think one thing to keep in mind is I did a study of like who drives. So I did a car master plan as my activity. I took that Portland State University PBOK class.
Oh, I heard about that. Yeah. Tell us about that. What was your project?
So one of the things that I came up with was, you know, I don't know if I'm sure you know, but your listeners might not know. Roger Geller did the four types of bicyclists. And I did a study on the four types of drivers. And the four types of drivers are the entitled driver, the habituated driver, the reluctant driver, and the non-driver. And the driver percentages of each, I kind of estimated the same way Roger Geller did, which was sort of made it up a little bit. But the one category that was, so 60% of the people are drivers and 40% are non-drivers. That was the amazing thing that came out of it. So the 40% of non-drivers includes the disabled community, people too old to drive, people who can't afford to drive, and children and teens who can't drive yet, but they are legitimate users of the road. That's 40% of the people that are completely ignored by the transportation department at this point. And of that 40%, about a third is the people who are other abled. 30% is people too poor to afford to drive, and 30% are kids. And then there's a small percentage of people who are the kind of wealthy, they prefer to be non-drivers. But paying attention to that 40%, I think, is an important part of getting the equity piece right, is saying, you know, we need to be teaching people who are other abled how to use bikes. We need to be working in low income housing areas to teach people biking. We need to get kids learning the basic skills of biking when they're in grade school, because learning to balance on a bike when you're young is a whole lot easier than teaching adults how to balance on a bike when they're older. We need to be teaching high school kids how to get around by bike. You know, all of these non-drivers are people that could add up to that 25% mode share of people biking. And it's not us. It's not people like us who've had, you know, decades to learn how to be good people on bikes. It's people who are non-drivers who are ignored by the transportation system that really need to be brought into the transportation world. And I think that's what the focus of the next couple of years of Bike Loud is going to be. It's going to be on how to reach out to not us, you know, not the people who are listening to Bike Portland today, but to reach out to that broader community. It's reaching out to the high school programs that should be teaching kids basic bike repair instead of car repair. You know, I mean, it's a lot of that stuff that needs to happen in order to get to that large percentage of people on bikes.
Right. Interesting. So, yeah. So like you may have identified there, and I think you did a good job of explaining, maybe a different approach for bike advocates, where we're not going to worry as much about, you know, getting City Hall people to agree with us, or doing, you know, talking about a local business that's bike friendly. Like, those are kind of these traditional things that we do in the past. Now it's like, go to the street, go to the community, talk to these people that are non-drivers, as you've identified, let's say, and just organize with them, organize, get them to see that there can be a future with a biking city, and how all the benefits that biking can have and a people-centered neighborhood can have. So that's really wonderful. I agree with that vision. I think it's a good way to approach it. And I wonder if you can just elaborate a little bit more on why you decided to sort of like work with Bike Loud PDX. I mean, I know you're somebody who does their research. You're somebody who, you know, you came to town, and I know you took a look at the landscape and thought, okay, I still want to be in this game. I still want to do work to promote the kind of city I want. And I'm going to work with Bike Loud. Is there something about their approach, or kind of what you see them doing as sort of this, they've been around 5 or 6 years, but I still think of them as an upstart. But can you tell me about that? Why decide to go and work with Bike Loud and be a big volunteer for them at this point?
Well, they are an upstart. I mean, they just last week signed the paperwork to become a 501c3 organization. You know, they're still developing. I mean, one of the things that I love about the Bike Loud approach is that it does have this kind of diversity of approaches. There are people on the board who are bike mechanics and engineers and medical professionals and tech people and disability rights people, and they're looking at a common way to approach biking. I think that there's a lot of emphasis on biking as a climate activity that I don't see in a lot of bike. I mean, everybody says, oh yeah, you bike for the climate, but I think that there's actually a real understanding of the climate impacts of biking and not biking. I think that was another thing that really drew me into that. As you said, I've been a climate advocate for forever. And biking really takes a ton of carbon out of the atmosphere. Your listeners all know that burning 1 gallon of gas produces 20 pounds of CO2. I mean, there's insane amounts of carbon that are involved in any kind of driving. And you really do change the equation entirely. I mean, this is the reason that not only that I like to bike to get to places, but it's the main reason I got into biking, is that it was a huge climate impact.
Yeah, and judging from the various timelines of people involved with Bike Loud that I follow recently, there's been this, I feel like there's been a very big focus on going back into the 2010 bike plan, the bike plan in Portland that was passed in 2010. And like again, pulling out that 25% by 2030 number and reminding Portland that we adopted it and passed that. But like you said, with like an approach that focuses on non-drivers and like people with disabilities, people of color, none of that was in the 2010 bike plan. There wasn't a huge focus on climate change in the bike plan. There wasn't a lot of talk about those, like I said, those non-drivers. It was really infrastructure-based and education-based, sort of the classic approach. So do you think, and not only that, but the bike plan has been traditionally a really big focus for Bike Loud. I think that some of their best work has been like reminding the city it exists and trying to make it better. Do you think that plan is still relevant? And I think I'm asking you specifically because I know, again, you've read hundreds and hundreds of city plans. You know these things. When we have a situation like our bike plan, which passed in 2010, and you probably saw the comments from the current transportation commissioner who was sort of like caught unaware of even what it was and sort of dismissed the goals in it, that kind of thing. Is what do we do? Do we ask for like an amendment to the bike plan, a formal amendment? Do we forget about it and act like it's not there? Do we dust it off and hold it up in front of people's face and say, here's what we agreed to? What do you think about that?
I mean, plans are like newspaper stories. They're very accurate and very relevant for the time they're written. But, you know, this is 12 years on from when it was written. And, you know, I mean, if you go back to an article that you wrote 12 years ago, yeah, of course it's going to be true. It's going to be accurate, but it's also going to be different. The situation is going to be different. You know, plans are not written in stone. They're not written on asphalt. They are, they're plans. They're ideas for the time that they were written. And there's solid information in there. There's some solid work plans that came out of the bike plan, but you have to adjust as time moves on. I think the goal of 25% mode share is completely reasonable. The fact that we're only at 5% right now is terrible. You know, I think that's not what a bike city, it doesn't even come close to what a bike city needs to be.
Yeah. And in a current political and social climate that has so much, oh boy, so many crises going on, it feels like some of them that, well, several of them feel existential to people for sure, I think reasonably. You know, it occurs to me like, so I was reading a news story about you from 2019 during your campaign, and somebody characterized you as being, quote, while other candidates tend to focus on what people need to survive, Tuttle talks about what they need to enjoy themselves and each other. And I'm not saying that that's an accurate description of you, but I think it gets to a problem we as transportation reform people are facing and have faced in recent years, which is how do we counter a sort of narrative or perception among other people and in the media and even a lot of elected officials who are sort of like seeing the stuff we care about as sort of nice to haves while they have other constituents who, you know, don't have a place to live, can't, you know, or face brutality from, you know, the government or from law enforcement or are ravaged, their business is ravaged by a pandemic, right? These, or, you know, or they can't afford, or they're being, you know, displaced out of their neighborhoods because they can't afford rent, all these things. What do you think is a good way to sort of frame these things about moving around in a way that, you know, garners respect and, you know, biking and walking and using transit and all that stuff? How can we make that sort of hold the space amongst such severe and important issues?
I mean, our whole country is going, our whole world is going through severe disruption right now. And we need to pay attention to the fact that people don't have homes, that they don't have enough to eat, that they're, you know, in war zones, or, you know, that terrible things are happening in the world right now. But we also need to be human, to live our lives, to find joy in the things that we can do. I think a lot of the times that biking gets pitted against the need for people to have to drive places. And I think that that's something that we really need to disabuse people of, because, you know, we've forced ourselves into a corner in America in particular, where we've moved people away from the places they need to go so that there is no way to get to those places without having the use of a car, because we haven't provided safe ways for them to get to those places by bike or sufficient transit for people to use to get to the places they need to go. And this is particularly a problem if you're poor, you know, you're moved out of the zone where you can get to places by walking, biking, or using transit. And I think that that's something that we need to fix right away in order for us to actually have an equitable transportation system. I think so many of our transportation choices are still so car-based, and there's still so much investment in moving people around by car, when what people really need is ways to get around, not ways to get around by car. But the car has always been the default. And I think that, you know, I think that this is something that, you know, we're seeing a lot in cities that are starting to focus on people-based transportation systems, is that that movement, when you're actually thinking about people first, when you plan for transportation for people first, when people can walk and use transit and bike around and those feel like comfortable modes, that that changes the whole tenor of the community as well. That people start to get to know their neighbors. They start to be able to talk to each other on the bus or waiting for the bus or walking to the supermarket or, you know, waiting to pick up their kids by bike at school. I mean, all of those things are community building things that come along with a people-centered transportation system that don't come along with a car-based transportation system. So I think that building healthy cities starts with figuring out ways to move people rather than moving cars.
And do you think that equation has shifted fundamentally and sort of permanently, or shifted in a significant way because of the pandemic? And I'm talking about, so much of our planning and focus has been from, right, moving people from where they live to where they work. And if we assume, and I think we can, that a great percentage of people are no longer going to make those trips, does that change? Do we need to then focus on neighborhood to neighborhood destination, you know, trip, you know, point A and B versus neighborhood to central city? Or, like, have you thought about that at all in terms of how that changes the way folks like you should be advocating and pushing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even pre-pandemic, the trip to work was still only 25% of trips.
True.
Right.
But it carried so much weight. It carried so much weight in, like, the way people perceive this whole conversation.
It was the easy thing for planners to measure. That was the easy thing for politicians to point to and for businesses to get behind, was the trip to work. But it was still only a quarter. And now I bet that's been cut in half. I don't have the numbers.
Yeah. But, well, it was also very reassuring for me as sort of a bike activist person. It was so reassuring to see those platoons of bikers going, like, stopped at a stop sign on the peak commuting routes, of which there are several in Portland, like these just, you know, dozens and dozens of people going up North Williams Avenue. And it occurred to me, yet, you know, recently, that we're not seeing that anymore. And it's a little depressing for me to not see that, because it was so uplifting when I did see it. And I'm just thinking of other people who aren't bike activists. If you're a politician, you know, you're no longer having that tangible visual thing of a bunch of bikers in Portland, and it is seeping into the conversations. You're starting to hear people sort of question investment in this stuff more because they're not seeing all the bikers. So I think that's a really interesting issue moving forward, is how do we shift how we do this kind of stuff, because this whole trip to work sort of peak hour commute thing has shifted. So anyway, just to put that out there.
Yeah, and people are getting around at other times other than that, those peak work hours. So we need to be measuring those things. And, you know, how actually this is something that PBOT staff and Bike Loud people are talking about, is how they're actually measuring that percentage of people going by bike, so that if we're actually holding the city accountable for a 25% mode split, what does that actually look like? We need to get those numbers right. But yeah, I mean, how people are traveling now is to go shopping, to run personal errands, for recreational things. The school trip is really significant. You know, all of those things need to be taken into account. And we have to figure out ways to make those possible without the use of a car.
Yes, I agree. And you mentioned before the value of having an elected leader, a champion in elected office. And I know you had a close personal relationship with former Seattle City Council member Sally Bagshaw. You two even went e-bike shopping together, right, at one point. So who is Portland's Sally Bagshaw? Do we even need one? Like, what? Anybody in the wings you think could be that?
There are a number of them actually at the state level. Mm. But I haven't really found one at the city or kind of metro level yet. But I think, you know, that any of them could become that champion with enough community interest in them becoming that kind of a champion.
It's still shocking to me to think about that. I think it was the 2016 election in Portland, where a group held a transportation-centric candidate forum. And it was the first time I remember I was in the back and I was talked to somebody next to me, and I looked at him and I said, look at the stage. This was a bunch of candidates, probably a dozen. I said, there's nobody on that stage who's really like a transportation person or like a bike reformer or that kind of activist. And I think we'd had that in Portland since the 70s and 80s. And I think, and we still don't have that. And it's still shocking when even you, given sort of your background and your eye for these things, you sort of agree that there's not really that one person. I think there are people who are supportive, but they haven't really emerged. And I think it gets back to what we were talking about before about the change in tone of bike advocacy in general. It's no longer like something that an elected official would grab onto in and of itself, just because the way we talk about it has changed so much. It's no longer like this cool, sexy thing that used to be on everybody's lips back, you know, 2010, 2008 and stuff. So it's still, when to hear you even say that is still really surprising to me. So
there are definitely people in the Seattle City Council that have biking in their portfolio of things to support.
Yes, I think it will be interesting to see how that plays out in the sort of months, and I won't say years, I'll say months ahead, because I hope someone does emerge, because I think if done right and if it's sort of understood and presented in the right way, bicycling is definitely something that I think an elected official in this city of all cities could and should get behind. So
it could easily be somebody who's actually on the council now, or you know, because you have to be brought to that idea. Not everybody is in, you know, Earl Blumenauer.
Yeah. And I'm not even, for folks that hear this wrong, I mean, maybe I could debate this still, but I don't think it's even a necessity that you're sort of like, you know, bike centric or really can be. It's just somebody, it has to be somebody who can really sort of get it beyond just, you know, doing the thing that beyond just looking at the transportation department and going, yes, that stuff's good, let's do more of it. It's got to be somebody who really like wants to push to the next level. So, and again, anybody hearing this that's going like, why isn't he mentioning Commissioner Joanne Hardesty? Well, I actually do think she is potentially that champion. I think she's getting really close to that. And you could almost argue, I just got an email from her staff today about recapping the whole year she's had as transportation commissioner. It's a pretty impressive list. I try to be really critical, but I'm starting to feel that, you know, she has actually done a little more than just saying yes to like what the city transportation department's already doing, and has actually helped push them and give them more confidence to do even more. So that's sort of an unanswered question for another day. But
yeah, and I was really hoping that Commissioner Hardesty would be that person because of her strong climate background, and that she would see the use of non-car transportation as a huge climate issue and an equity issue, a huge equity issue.
I think she does. I think there's just a few things that need to shift for her to, I think, I don't know. And again, there's no coming out party for an official champion on this stuff. It just sort of emerges. But I think part of it with her may not be what's in her heart. It might be what she's just as a human capacity able to deal with, because there are other, and it gets back to what I said about before, about having other huge issues on the plate right now. And those are things where those are her really stock and trade. And I just think at the end of the day, she hasn't necessarily figured out a way to sort of make the time for this transportation mobility related stuff in a way that she has with other issues, or to spend the political capital in the same way. But I think she could. And I think what's interesting is that she's finding in her reelection, I think she's shifting a little bit more to transportation because she's facing a reelection. So that's a good sign, I think, for transportation advocates, that she's seeing that as a viable issue and a viable community to appeal to get reelected.
I mean, something that she brings up a lot is that PBOT, Portland Bureau of Transportation, has a $4 billion backlog of maintenance, you know, and so can't have nice things like sidewalks and bike lanes. Well, first of all, you know, you have to like rethink the whole transportation system. And what that $4 billion represents is putting more asphalt on streets for cars. It's not $4 billion to transform streets for people who walk, for people who need to get around. And, you know, I did part of my car master plan study is I did a study of how many square feet of Portland was covered by asphalt. You want to know?
Yes.
So 25.
And we're going to link to this car master plan in the show notes, everybody.
So 25% of most American cities, 25 to 30% is asphalt covered. That's just the sad fact of things. So in Portland, it is 36 square miles of asphalt that we have to maintain with 3 to 9 inches of asphalt.
And that's specifically transportation right of way, not just asphalt in general, like school playgrounds and stuff. Yeah, okay, you're talking streets.
And people can't like picture 36 square miles, but people can picture square feet, you know, because you have a square foot apartment or you have a square foot, you know, whatever, lawn. And it is 1 billion square feet is covered with asphalt.
Wow. And I hear what you're saying about having that conversation with like someone like Commissioner Hardesty, who constantly brings up, well, we have this $4 billion maintenance backlog. Like, I literally had her say that to me when I was interviewing her recently and tried my best to try to reorient like how she was seeing that. But I think it's illustrative of how hard it is to sort of counter that, because like you said, it does require like a whole new lens on the system, because the default is that we have to make roads to the standard that you can drive a truck on them.
Right. And you have to keep on pouring more and more oil, you know, I mean, asphalt to produce it is like 100 to 200 pounds of CO2 equivalent per yard.
Right.
So it's a lot of carbon that we're just pouring and pouring and pouring on our billion square feet of roadway. You know, we have to think about it differently.
Yeah, I agree. And on a similar note of speaking of billions, one of the last things I want to talk about here, then I'll let you go, which is the Move Seattle levy, which you really were a big advocate for and champion for and helped get packed. It was $930 million package for transportation stuff citywide. We, like I said before, Portland tried and failed to do something similar to this in 2020. But now we have another shot. We have federal money coming down. Anything you can share with us, given all your experience of sort of like how people as advocates or even the city staff listening to this, what can we do to prep for this? What kind of opportunity could this be for Portland?
You know, I think that there are all of these kind of wide open coffers waiting for this money to fall into it that have a lot to do with highways, that have a lot to do with maintaining those billions of square feet for cars. You know, I think that is a giant challenge that we really do need to get behind. And I think that, you know, you have to kind of open your eyes about where that money is going, because it is multiple billions of dollars that is coming. And it's going to be the last kind of major capital investment for decades.
Even more important, I think, because cities are really reeling economically from the pandemic. So it's going to be more important.
So something that we're looking at in the Seattle context is unions too. I mean, I think that they're a big, big voice in how that money is spent, because the good, quote unquote, good union jobs are for highway repair, for highway construction. But there are also a lot of good union jobs for people working at Fred Meyer. You know, there are a lot of good union jobs for low-income wage jobs that are all over the region that people would like to get to by ways other than taking their cars to. So, you know, there's the unions of, you know, the short-term gain of building a road, but then there's also the longer-term gain of building a network of places that people can walk and bike to.
And there can be no mention of jobs without reminding people that there are just as many, if not more, jobs in building bike paths, sidewalks, and transit stuff. So if someone listening to this is inspired by your words and your background, Kathy, and they want to sort of get engaged and plug in, you did that. You came here and in 6 months, you've really, I think, got a good handle on things. What's your advice for someone that wants to get a little bit more engaged here in Portland and become part of the effort to change things?
I mean, I love what Bike Loud is doing. They've broken into local districts, you know, into three different kind of sub-districts where people are doing local projects. But the goal there is to get thousands of people into that Bike Loud system to be reaching out to teach the skills that they have to elementary school students to people living to do bike buddy programs in low-income communities. There's so many different ways you can plug in, you know, whether you're a tech person, whether you're a person who likes to teach other people how to bike. I mean, I assume that's what a lot of your listeners are. It's going to take a whole village of people who already bike to actually raise up a whole city of people who bike. And so, join Bike Loud.
And also follow Kathy on Twitter at Kathy Tuttle, T-U-T-T-L-E, and stay abreast of all the great stuff she's doing. And again, Kathy, thanks for talking today. I really appreciate it. And I know I will be seeing you on the street really soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jonathan.
That was Kathy Tuttle, an independent transportation advocate and Bike Loud PDX board member. Be sure to check our show notes for links and resources mentioned in this episode. The Bike Portland podcast is a production of Pedaltown Media Incorporated and is made possible by listeners just like you. If you're not a subscriber yet, please become one today at bikeportland.org/support. You can listen to more episodes and find out how to subscribe at bikeportland.org/podcast. Our theme music is by Kevin Hartnell, and I'm your host, Jonathan Maas. Until next time, thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the streets.